Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. For the past 2.5 hours, just before we rejoined the takeaway, we brought you live coverage of the House Intelligence Committee chaired by Los Angeles area Democrat Adam Schiff as they talked with the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire. Democrats challenging the DNI over why the whistleblower complaint against President Trump in his conversation with the Ukrainian president had not been presented to the committee within the 7 days that is typically specified for these cases. Let's listen to an exchange between the chairman of the committee, Congressman Adam Schiff, and the acting director of national intelligence, Mr. McGuire.
You would concur, would you not, Director, that this complaint alleging serious wrongdoing by the president was credible?
It's not for me to judge, sir.
It is for you to judge, apparently. I mean, I agree it's not for you to judge. You shall provide it to Congress. But indeed, you did judge whether this complaint should be provided to Congress. Can we at least agree that the Inspector General made a sound conclusion that this whistleblower complaint was credible?
That is correct. That is in the cover letter that's been provided to the committee. I believe that's also made public. The decision and the recommendation by the Inspector General that, in fact, the allegation was credible.
Now, Ranking Member Devin Nunes of California also took up the issue of credibility of the whistleblower with the head of DNI.
I just want to get one thing straight, because one of the quotes they're going to use from you is you saying that this was a credible complaint. That will be used and spun as you're saying that it was true. And I want to give you an opportunity to, you have not investigated the veracity or the truthfulness of this complaint.
That's correct, Ranking Member. The determination on credible was made by the IC Inspector General. He made the determination that it is credible, and he also made the determination of urgent concern. My question was not, I did not question his judgment there. The question I had was, does in fact this allegation of wrongdoing meet the criteria, the statutory criteria of urgent concern? And the other issue, as I said, complicated things. Did it, in fact, the allegations within this whistleblower complaint involve executive privilege?
Joining us to talk about the hearing this morning, the House Intelligence Committee, is Daniel Lipman, White House reporter for Politico. Daniel, good to have you with us again. First of all, there are a number of issues that were at the center of this, one of which is the exercise of executive privilege and the White House, this conversation with the Ukrainian president, claiming that this falls under that, and we heard from the DNI that that was the reason this was not shared, along with this not being an issue of urgent concern. Can you elaborate a bit on the back and forth on those two issues?
You know, this is a major part of everything that we've been discussing in terms of they are trying to use executive privilege to shield the White House was trying to use that to prevent this whistleblower complaint from seeing the light of day, because usually the president's conversations internally and with foreign leaders, they could fall into their rubric. But the issue is his conduct and his offering, his solicitation of foreign help for the next election. And, you know, illegal stuff does not count as something you can get away with by saying, oh, well, it's executive privilege. And so that's why that's one reason why that explanation did not hold water.
Hmm. So you don't think it is possible when you're talking about the president having a conversation with a foreign leader that that could fall under, because then couldn't you theoretically make the claim of malfeasance in potentially any conversation that a president has?
Well, you can always make any type of claim, but most presidents are not using their foreign leader calls to get personal favors done for them by that foreign government for their reelection and to hurt their political rivals like Joe Biden. And so that's something that is kind of unprecedented. And Joseph McGuire said that this complaint and this dispute was not something that the intelligence community's inspector general is usually equipped to handle, since they're more focused on intelligence wrongdoing, and this is more wrongdoing by the President of the United States.
We're talking with Daniel Lipman, White House reporter for Politico. Also with us is Robert Turner from the University of Virginia, law professor and distinguished fellow with UVA's Center for National Security Law. Professor Turner, thank you for being with us. On this matter of executive power that went back and forth on a partisan basis with the members of the committee, what are the limits of that claim of executive privilege in a conversation like this?
Well, when we're talking in the area of intelligence and foreign affairs, the president has tremendous powers that are largely unchecked by Congress. The Senate has a negative over ambassadorial appointments, over treaties, but generally the founding fathers understood that intelligence was to be the province of the executive. Indeed, in Federalist Number 64, John Jay explained there would be foreign sources of intelligence who would be willing to confide in the secrecy of the president, but not in that of the Senate or more popularly elected like the House or the Senate today. And he said, therefore, the Constitution had left the president, quote, able to manage the business of intelligence as prudence might suggest. Just one other example, when Congress passed its first appropriation bill for foreign intercourse or foreign affairs in 1790, it said, quote, the president shall account specifically for all such expenditures of the said money as in his judgment may be made public, and also for the amount of such expenditures as he may think it advisable not to specify, and cause a regular statement and account thereof to be laid before Congress annually. So the point is, they understood, and this really went on until the 1970s, when Congress, in the wake of Vietnam, set up the first intelligence committees. Prior to that, there was a broad consensus in all three departments that intelligence was the prerogative of the president.
So what then is a practical matter is the check on a president using a phone call like this, where, as is contended here, he's trying to benefit his political prospects. What is the check?
Well, it's largely unchecked. And if you go, if your readers will Google Marbury versus Madison, probably the most famous of all Supreme Court cases, when Chief Justice John Marshall in 1802, among other things, noted that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. He also talked about the president having important political powers for which he's only accountable to his conscience and to his character. If the people vote him out, the people can do that. But he said these powers affect the nation, not individual rights. And being entrusted to the executive, the decision of the executive is final. And this is the Supreme Court in 1936 in the Curtis Wright decision noted that the Senate could not intrude into diplomatic negotiations, and Congress itself is powerless to do so. So this is an area. What they drew a balance. Generally, they wanted checks. You know, okay. they modified Locke. But in the area, the national security area, where if the information became public, it might cause us to go to war or even to lose a war, they gave the president some unchecked powers, just as the he also has the unchecked power to grant pardons. Congress okay. tried to pass a law on that, and it was struck down by the court.
Let me bring into the conversation R.P. Eddy, chairman of the New York-based intelligence firm Ergo. He's former director of the White House National Security Council back in the mid-1990s. Mr. Eddy, good to have you with us again. What do you see as the check on the president's authority here to claim executive privilege?
Nice to be back, Larry. The privilege conversation is interesting, but I think I would actually argue that if the president wanted to argue for privilege in releasing this transcript, he probably could have had a fairly successful conversation. The way we used to think about it inside national security politics is, will oversight of this topic by Congress or anyone else hinder the president and his ability to execute national security issues? So, you know, you could make an argument here, but it's notable that he released the entire thing without trying to exert privilege. So the privileged conversation's sort of over, isn't it? He's already released the transcript, and the IG report has already been released. So it's interesting to get on to the content of it, I'd say, because at this point, privilege has been waived in those two topics. And now, will they try to exert privilege on other aspects of this that might come forward? They probably will, because I think they're starting to realize how serious the stakes are here as impeachment has begun.
Well, and let's look at the whistleblower complaint, as you suggest, because what is alleged here, in addition to what is included in the transcript of that telephone call, there is also the allegation by the whistleblower that members of the White House staff understood that the president had crossed a line in his conversation with the Ukrainian president, and that as a result, they attempted to hide the transcript of that conversation so it wouldn't see the light of day by putting it essentially into a secret classification, which would keep it from being seen by others. First of all, have you in your career working in intelligence come across anything like this in the past, an allegation like this?
So having worked in the Situation Room, having been on presidential phone calls, having seen the transcripts being written, been through this entire process, having seen where they're stored, and the systems are probably still relatively similar, I don't find it to be a big concern that they put it into a classified system. In fact, I guarantee you whatever system was in the beginning was also a classified system. No conversation about with the president, with the foreign leader is going to be floating around in an unclassified, unsecured system. So I'm not quite sure what they're speaking of as to being moved. It might have been moved into certain channels or something that's called a special access program. So if they moved it into something extremely classified, there's an argument there. But it was probably classified the whole time. Now, the broader question is, which you asked, is have I seen anything like this? And I've worked with a number of presidents. And no, none of us have, right? This is an absolutely extraordinary situation, and we all have to sort of stop and catch our breath and realize that. We now have effectively a recording. We have effectively a word-to-word transcript of the President of the United States asking a foreign leader for help with his political election. And that's, you know, that's profound. And no, we've never seen anything like it. And I was thinking about when I was at the National Security Council, if we had seen anything like this, what we would have done. And there are parallels. You can think back to when in the Clinton administration there were people being admitted for visits to the White House who were potentially donors who shouldn't have been there. Whistleblowers came out on that. Obviously, Monica Lewinsky, whistleblowers came out on that. And something like this, I think we would fall back in our chairs. This is an extraordinary thing to hear a president of the United States say. Normally, these are very disciplined conversations. They're following talking points. The entire government has weighed in. You know, Treasury wants you to make sure you have this point of view, and FBI needs you to help extradite this person, and CIA wants you to ask for this, and state wants to make sure you do this. And there's a whole list of stuff they have to bring through because it's a very important communication between two countries.
One of the things Democrats raised multiple occasions during the House Intelligence Committee hearing was whether the fact that initially this was not passed off to Congress would have a chilling effect on future whistleblower disclosures or allegations. What do you think of that?
No, I don't. I think it's actually been handled very well. I was impressed to see the way the memo was written. Obviously, the person who wrote the whistleblower complaint is a serious senior. Whatever their job is, they're fairly high level. They put together a very strong argument. They're strong writers, so it's a serious person with a serious job and lots of access. And the inspector general did pass it along. And look, when you get to a senior level, you are very aware politics gets in the middle of all these things. That's why we talked about privilege for a while, and now we're talking about the Inspector General report itself, like how was that handled? No, I don't think so. Now, how this person is treated going forward will be very interesting. If this person decides to reveal themselves, people will recognize that's their choice. If this person is outed without revealing themselves, that will have a chilling effect.
Does it seem odd to you, RP, that this individual didn't have firsthand knowledge but is describing multiple people with whom he or she talked who shared these concerns, this information? It wasn't those individuals that raised the red flag. It was this person who didn't have firsthand knowledge of it. And do whistleblower complaints typically or often occur in that way?
In any possible way. Recall that this person is correct, right? So this person said, I understand this conversation happened. I wasn't there. They were honest about it right in the front. And lo and behold, here's the transcript. It did happen, just as reported by the whistleblower. So in many instances, of course, and you can also presume that the conversations that this person had, the whistleblower had with folks who were firsthand to this, was probably a classified conversation. It's a serious conversation. It's not water cooler talk. Even inside the Situation Room, even inside the NSC, you don't go from desk to desk to desk talking about different things you learned that day. Everything is compartmented. Everything lives in need to know. So however this person heard it, most likely it was in an official capacity with real meetings under the seal of classification. So, and yes, Inspector General's reports, whistleblower complaints can come in all sorts of guises.
I know it's not possible to speak for a community as vast as American intelligence interests, but what's your sense of how this all is being received by people in that community?
Pride. I think there's a degree of pride that the system's working, that people are stepping up with something they're concerned about. The intelligence community is really no different than the rest of the American community. There are some obvious differences, but confirmation bias, one way or the other, will behold any group. So folks are looking at this just as maybe people on this call or people listening to us saying, look, I read the transcript. I have no idea what RPID is talking about. I don't see the president asking for help in an election. And others of us look at it and go, I see it very clearly. So, you know, well-meaning people on both sides of this argument literally see a different thing. It's a Rashomon. It's confirmation bias. That happens inside the intelligence community as well. There are people on both sides. The intelligence community, though, because they're generally deeper professionals, are probably more upset, more disappointed about this than the average person, I'd say.
RP, before I let you go, given that we're in such a hyper-partisan era here, and I'm assuming intelligence professionals take pride in being apart from that sort of motivation or influence, but is it more difficult now for intelligence professionals, even people who've been doing this for years, to stay out of that fray?
There are people inside the military, the intelligence service, and the diplomatic service who don't vote, and they intentionally don't vote. It's not because they're not patriotic, it's not because they don't care, but they take an oath to remove themselves from the political situation by via taking an oath to serve any president who wins. The three communities I just mentioned are full of some of the greatest patriots you'd ever meet. I wouldn't call it partisanship. I would call it patriotism, right? And you could look at part. One thing I found was interesting was there were comments on this, the comments by the IG on this whistleblower report, the Inspector General on the whistleblower report, saying that there was evidence that the writer had partisan affiliation. You know, maybe the person that donated money to one party, you know, a Democrat or something like that. I don't know that that matters, right? You should look at this report or any other report and say, and presume best intent. This person, in any instance, both sides of the aisle, they presume best intent, which in this instance means, is this person being a patriot and upholding their sworn duties or not? So it doesn't have to be a partisan view that makes you look at this and go, wow, I think this president's a problem because I'm a real Democrat. It could be a patriotic point of view. I think this president's a problem because he's abusing the power of the office or any other number of things that people are complaining about this president on a partisan, not on a partisan basis, but on a patriotic basis.
RP Eddy, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Sorry I have to run. Thanks for having me.
That's right. Chairman of the intelligence firm Ergo, he's former director of the White House National Security Council for 3 years in the mid-1990s. We're talking about the whistleblower report that was released this morning, in which the person alleges not just that President Trump offered, what was it, de facto quid pro quo, to support his reelection effort with the Ukrainian president in exchange for military aid, but also that the White House staff, recognizing the phone call presented problems, wanted to bury the transcript of that conversation. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have many more guests to join us throughout the hour. Back in 1 minute. About an hour ago, the House Intelligence Committee, chaired by Angelino Adam Schiff, heard the testimony of the acting director of National Intelligence, who was defending the reasons why he had not initially presented the whistleblower's report of alleged misconduct by President Trump to the House of Representatives. We're talking not just about that hearing, but also about the memo itself, which was released this morning. Joining us to talk about its contents is Wendy Benjaminson, who's politics editor at Bloomberg. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us. Just on my reading of this, what looks like the significant issue is above the phone call itself, for which we had the transcript yesterday, was this allegation of White House staffers attempting to hide the transcript of the conversation. What else do you see here that's significant?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right, and thanks for having me on. The attempt to lock down the information was probably the most disturbing. I mean, Mr. Pieri was saying that, you know, a lot of conversations with foreign leaders are classified, and that's true. But the idea that this sort of this call that we now know was completely routine, would have been completely routine without the request for an investigation into the former vice president, that White House officials were so disturbed by what they heard that they decided to lock it down. It wasn't they decided to lock it down because he was talking about sensitive intelligence information, as your other guest said, but they were disturbed by the possible violations of law. And then the memo goes on to say that the people who listened to the call went straight to White House counsels because they realized or they believed that they had just witnessed the president doing something illegal and they wanted to protect themselves, which is a natural human reaction, of course. So that also was some of the, you know, blaring neon lights that came out of that whistleblower.
So what do we anticipate is going to be the House's efforts to try and determine if that in fact happened within the White House, if the whistleblower allegation of that is accurate?
They can subpoena documents. They can subpoena White House officials. Senator Kamala Harris, who's one of the Democratic presidential candidates, wants a bunch of White House officials subpoenaed to find out, what other phone calls they've locked down. On the other hand, we've had subpoenas flying back and forth across Pennsylvania Avenue for months now between the Capitol and the White House, and the White House hasn't responded to any of them except to challenge them in court. So what can they can file subpoenas, but whether those subpoenas are acknowledged is another question.
We heard a lot in the questioning today about executive privilege. And is it anticipated that that's something that members of the White House staff might attempt to invoke here, that this would be within the president's jurisdiction to not have staff members cooperate with the House?
Sure, they can try that. But it's been an argument that's fallen on deaf ears before, and it in the Capitol, and it probably will this time. I mean, the executive privilege resides in the president himself, I think, and they can. Director McGuire today said that his conversations with the president are privileged, and I can see that. But if you're a mid-level staffer who listened in on a phone call, I don't know. I honestly don't know whether that would be considered executive privilege or not.
What's next with hearings? The Senate, I think, is doing a closed-door Intelligence Committee hearing today. But do you know what else is on tap?
I honestly don't. I'm sorry. I just know that this is one of several investigations going on. This is the one that's sort of live and of the moment and certainly the least murky of all of them. Nancy Pelosi's impeachment inquiry covers six investigations that are going on, and they are all proceeding with the idea of whether anything is impeachable now. On the other hand, Congress leaves for 2 weeks after tomorrow's close of business, so things are going to come to a screeching halt for 2 weeks. Starting Friday night.
We're talking with Bloomberg's politics editor, Wendy Benjaminson, talking with her about the whistleblower document that came out today and what comes next with the House of Representatives. We heard from Nancy Pelosi this morning, who came out after hearing the testimony that was given, not pulling any punches whatsoever. She had, of course, been, you know, saying that the Democrats were not going to be pursuing impeachment. Now, it seems to me, Wendy, you know, she's full on supporting this and claiming that the whistleblower memo is even more disturbing than the contents of the call itself.
That's right. And it certainly seems that the whistleblower's memo is more disturbing than the call itself. The call itself has the President of the United States asking the President of Ukraine to do him a favor and look into two things. The firm that may or may not have hacked the Democrats' emails, which was actually the involvement what was with Russia, and for some reason the president thinks Ukraine was involved, which is, you know, is a wholly different country. And then, you know, he asks them to also, while they're at it, you know, go talk to Giuliani and Attorney General Barr about Joe Biden and his dealings with his son's business. But the whistleblower's complaint shows the effort to cover it up. And as we learned in the 1970s, it's the cover-up itself that usually leads to presidential downfalls.
Wendy, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Wendy Benjaminson, politics editor for Bloomberg, with us on Air Talk. Joining us now is Democratic Congressman Gil Cisneros, who represents the North Orange County 39th District, also includes portions of Southeast Los Angeles County as well. Congressman, thank you very much for being with us. You were one of six freshman members of Congress who wrote an op-ed condemning President Trump's actions. First of all, given that you're in a purple district that flipped, you have any concerns about being so out front critical of the president?
You know, I took an oath when I was 18 years old when I joined the Navy to support and defend the Constitution. I know my colleagues that I wrote the op-ed with, they did the same thing. You know, we took that oath again when we became members of Congress to again support and defend the Constitution. For us, this was a situation that was, you know, just an incredible situation where the president used his office to really put our national security in jeopardy by withholding funds to an ally, who's actually engaged in combat with one of our adversaries, that being Russia. And that's a threat to our national security and to all of us. That was something we couldn't stand up for. And for us, it wasn't about politics. It wasn't about winning elections. It was about doing what was right. And that's why we spoke up, and that's why we wrote the op-ed.
So you saw the president's statement as a clear quid pro quo.
Well, like Adam Schiff has said, it doesn't have to be a quid pro quo. You know, the president engages in these these things that are often kind of seem like something that a mafia boss would do. You know, he kind of makes suggestions that, hey, I need you to do this or do me this favor. You know, the mafia boss never goes and says, hey, go kill this guy. He kind of makes, you know, indicates or kind of makes implies that this is what I need you to do or to go see this individual. And that's the way the president acts.
I don't, but I would take issue with it. I think President Trump is pretty blunt, actually. And where have you seen places where he sort of hinted at things as supportive of doing it sort of, you know, club in hand versus the subtle way?
Well, it is right. But, you know, their argument is right now is that, hey, the president never said, you know, I want this for that. You know, he kind of said, hey, do me a favor. And that's really, it doesn't have to be, you know, this for that, like Adam Schiff said. You know, the president had gone to Ukraine, the Ukrainian president, and asked him to do him a favor. And at the time that he's asked him to do this favor, he's withholding funds that we, Congress, authorized for the Ukrainian government to fight our adversary, Russia. And, you know, he was trying to get them to investigate Joe Biden, who's going to be, you know, could potentially be his opponent in the upcoming presidential general election. You know, he is using the power of his office for his own personal and political gain, and that's not right. And that's why we stood up, and that's why we spoke up, and that's why we have decided that, you know, we needed to write this editorial and we needed to look into this as to, you know, to get to the bottom of this. And that's why we encourage the impeachment hearings.
We're talking with Democratic member of Congress Gil Cisneros. He represents the 39th District of North Orange County and a portion of Southeast L.A. County as well. Fullerton, Diamond Bar, La Habra, other communities are within his district. This is a district that flipped from Republican to Democratic representation. We're talking with him about the reasons that he's come out strongly in condemnation of President Trump's actions in that phone call with the Ukrainian president. Congressman, are you concerned at all about potential backlash from full-on articles of impeachment being passed by the House?
The Intelligence Committee right now is investigating. They're going to take the lead on this. They're going to get to the bottom of it. They're going to get the information. They will present this information once they have it all and when they to the House of Representatives. And, you know, if the direction that we're seeing right now is the way it's going, knowing, you know, having the whistleblower statement now, having not the transcript, but just a memorandum of the conversation that the president had with the Ukrainian president, you know, it kind of looks like, well, we're headed in a direction where we could possibly have impeachment. But I am not worried about that. Like I said, I think this was the right thing to do. It wasn't a political decision that I made. It was a decision because our national security is threatened right now. It's being threatened by this president. And that's why I decided to speak up. And I will continue to speak up anytime I see a threat to our national security and our nation.
Congressman, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gil Cisneros, Democrat, California's 39th District, predominantly an Orange County district, North County. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have other guests who'll be joining us as we talk about the whistleblower memo released this morning, as well as the House Intelligence Committee's hearing in which the acting director of national intelligence was questioned about the process for that whistleblower complaint not making its way to the House. We'll be back right after a live update from Michelle Faust-Raghavan. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the House Intelligence Committee hearing this morning with the Director of National Intelligence. Also, the whistleblower memo, which was made public this morning as well. Presumably, the House of Representatives is going to try and see if it can corroborate the claim that White House staffers attempted to bury the transcript of the conversation between President Trump and the Ukrainian president because those staffers feared that the president had crossed a line in that conversation, didn't want it to be seen by anyone. Joining us is University of Virginia law professor and distinguished fellow Robert Turner. As a Professor Turner, your thoughts on what we're likely to see play out between the White House and Congress over efforts to corroborate the allegation of burying that transcript?
You know, I honestly don't know. I'm not sure what they're going to do. I think the president has a very strong claim to this, to protect this information. The problem is it would be politically very expensive to do that. Just for example, one of the powers given to the president, it's a duty and a power, in Article 2, is to see the laws faithfully executed. I'm not a big Trump fan, but I think he could make the case that if the government believes that a foreign government has information about criminal activity by an American abroad, it's within the president's power, just as the FBI, which has liaison offices around much of the world, could approach that government and say, do you have any information on this mobster or whatever that might, let's say we approach Italy about some alleged mafia boss or something like that. That's a normal activity. All of the executive power, except for the specific exceptions like the power of the Senate over nominations and treaties, the power of Congress to declare war, the rest of the executive power is vested exclusively in the president by Article 2, Section 1. Tom Jefferson is our first Secretary of Foreign Affairs, later renamed Secretary of State. wrote a letter to, or wrote a memo to George Washington in April of 1790, noting that the executive power was vested by the Constitution and the president, and saying the conduct of foreign relations is executive altogether and thus belonged to that department. When they first created the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1790, the statute instructed the secretary, it was later renamed Secretary of State, the secretary was instructed to conduct the business of the department as instructed by the president. So okay. The president has a lot of you know, of power in this area if he wants to do it. I'm not a Trump fan, but I've spent decades, you know, studying this area of the Constitution, and I think we have forgotten the original understanding. Let me just give you one
real quickly. Quote. Yeah.
Yeah, Ed Corwin, a distinguished con law scholar at Princeton, professor, in 1957 noted, quote, "It is today established that the president is final judge of what information he shall entrust to the Senate as to our relations with other governments." That was not challenged until about 1974, when Congress first asked for information on intelligence activities. That provision is found in the Foreign Relations Act of 1947, the National Security Act of 1947, but it was added there in the 70s as an amendment. That was not part of the original understanding.
But as a practical matter, the House has, as does the Senate, intelligence committees. They are constantly dealing with issues that are within a president's purview as well. And is that not, post-1974, de facto the way in which our government operates?
It is generally the way we operate, and I think it's clearly totally foreign to the original understanding of the framers, the understanding of the courts. All three branches understood that foreign affairs and particularly intelligence was a presidential prerogative. And during the heated debates, it's almost as if the nation's hard drive melted down during the heated debates during and following the Vietnam War. And today, almost nobody knows this history. I did a 1,700-page doctoral dissertation on this, and so I got really down into the weeds. And to me, it's absolutely clear the president has the constitutional power, and that power can't be taken away by a mere statute.
Well, we'll see if the president cites that, his legal team, as part of the investigation into the allegations in the whistleblower's complaint. Robert Turner, University of Virginia law professor. Also with us, Irving McCullough, national security analyst for the Government Accountability Project, which represents whistleblowers. Mr. McCullough, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, one of the things that the president has said here is that, no one complained when Joe Biden, as vice president, made the demand of the then Ukrainian president that the prosecutor there be removed, when that prosecutor at some point had been investigating the company that for which Hunter Biden served on its board. Can you compare that with the president's phone conversation with the current Ukrainian president?
Well, to be fair, we don't know if any whistleblowers ever came forward under the Obama administration. What we do know is that a whistleblower who was familiar with that conversation did, in fact, come forward to the intelligence community inspector general in this case. And that Trump appointee, that watchdog, actually substantiated their complaint. They said it was credible and they said it was urgent.
All right. And so in terms of the president's ability to be able to claim that he has wide latitude here, and the president claimed, look, this was an innocent call. There was nothing here that was quid pro quo. I wasn't trying to pressure the Ukrainian president. Your response to that?
Well, I think that a lot of the documents that have been discussed and that the president was declaring privileged originally have now been released. So that privilege is then waived. The only place I've seen executive privilege being asserted was actually during the hearing itself, where the acting director of national intelligence refused to comment on whether or not he had told the president about the complaint or if he discussed the complaint specifically with the president. He asserted privilege there.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation with Irvin McCullough. His organization represents whistleblowers, the Government Accountability Project. Robert Turner, law professor at the University of Virginia, with us as well. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Throughout the course of the day, you'll hear coverage on NPR programming, as well as Michelle Faust-Raghavan's updates throughout the middle of the day. What's going on with the House of Representatives, where earlier today there's about a 2.5-hour hearing involving the acting director of national intelligence, the committee presided over by Los Angeles area Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff. And we have the whistleblower memo that was also released this morning. With us, Irvin McCullough, who's national security analyst for the Government Accountability Project, which represents whistleblowers. Mr. McCullough, in a case like this, this document, and one of the things that the president has attacked about its credibility is that this is based on, you know, what someone has heard from other sources. Now, that has been corroborated in the transcript of the telephone call. It doesn't mean that necessarily all of what's in the whistleblower complaint is accurate. But how frequently are the whistleblowers your organization works with people who haven't necessarily had firsthand experience, but have heard about it from multiple other sources?
Well, that's actually extremely common. It's very hard for one person to be omnipresent and all-seeing and always having all of the information right in front of them. So what we like to do is have them talk to different people that do know things. And they'll get a lot of testimony from these folks that are in the know, and they'll put it together and piece together this mosaic that gives a clearer picture as to what misconduct is actually there. In this case, the whistleblower did just that and went to the Intelligence Community Inspector General, who said, despite not having direct access to the conversation, that this concern was credible and urgent, that it was real, that it was true.
Well, credible doesn't mean true. I mean, that was an important point. Devin Nunes, the congressman who's the ranking Republican, made is that credible just means you can't dismiss it out of hand, right? It's that it is potentially true. There's nothing that says this is an unbelievable claim. But credible doesn't mean that the allegations have been vetted and found to be substantiated.
Well, that's absolutely right, that you can't full front say that they are true. But we can say that they have been substantiated. That's actually the term of art when the inspector general goes through and conducts a preliminary review on a disclosure like this. They will say, we have substantiated these concerns as credible and urgent. Essentially, I've seen many whistleblowers lose at that stage. We take them to the inspectors general, and inspectors general do not have a good track record of substantiating concerns like this. I believe it's only 1 out of every 10 will receive this kind of substantiation treatment, which means that all that means is that there needs to be an investigation into what happened, that this is substantiated as credible. Now, I've seen so many whistleblowers lose at that stage that when I see the intelligence community inspector general, the Trump appointee, say that this is credible, I believe it. I believe that there's something there that needs to be investigated.
What do you think is the degree of investigation the attorney general does in a case like this? Do you think the inspector general likely had access to the transcript of the phone call? Do you think he likely would have talked with White House staffers who would have talked about how that transcript was handled?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the inspector general would. The inspector general, the intelligence community, has a very wide jurisdiction. There is essentially nothing inside the United States government or the United States intelligence community that the inspector general, the intelligence community, cannot access. There is no document that they can't get their hands on in the course of an investigation. And that's because they have this great power to meet their great responsibility of holding the entire intelligence community in check. Essentially, I'm very disappointed by the fact that the FBI, it appears, did not conduct a fulsome investigation. I'm disappointed by the fact that the FBI was even conducting this investigation. This should have been handled at the inspector general level. And then once they had more, they could have, if they witnessed criminal activity, they could have made a referral to the FBI. But not immediately. That's not usually how this goes.
Well, and at this point, now that this is the focal point of the impeachment inquiry in the House, is there any reason for the whistleblower to maintain privacy? Because it would say, you know, what potential blowback would there be on the person for we knowing who he or she is?
We have seen terminations, poor performance reviews, revocations of security clearances, which is essentially a blacklist in the national security world. All whistleblowers have all been subject to those kinds of actions. And when the president of the United States It came out, I believe, this morning, as the LA Times reported about 20 minutes ago, saying that we should handle this whistleblower as we did spies back in the day, quote unquote. I'm very fearful that this whistleblower will suffer some type of retaliation, despite the acting DNI's commitment to protect them from retaliation, as is required by the law.
We're talking with Irvin McCullough, national security analyst for the Government Accountability Project. It's based in D.C. It advocates and represents whistleblowers. We're talking with him about the memo which was made public today. Have we had precedent for this? I'm trying to think of a whistleblower memo. I know this was redacted, but one that where the essence of it has been released like this.
No, it is extraordinarily rare for a whistleblower memo, a whistleblower disclosure, to be fully released by the congressional intelligence committees in this process. Usually these things, after they undergo a thorough investigation, and usually these kinds of investigations can take anywhere from 6 months to 18 months, the inspector general will release some of the whistleblower disclosure with their findings and their legal analysis. But in this case, everything is moving so fast that the Congressional Intelligence Committees thought it best to implement a new transparency policy, essentially releasing the complaint after the White House released the transcript. I've never seen anything like that.
And I just wanted to quote from the Los Angeles Times story that you just mentioned, Irvin, the president who was speaking to an organization in New York this morning, a private event, said, basically speaking of the whistleblower, that person never saw the report, never saw the call, heard something, decided that he or she or whoever the hell they saw, they're almost a spy, President Trump said. I want to know who's the person who gave the whistleblower the information, because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? The spies and treason, we used to handle it a little differently than we do now. That was President Trump at a New York hotel where he was speaking at a private event. So it sounds like there, he's not speaking about the whistleblower per se, but an individual who gave the whistleblower information. But the whistleblower, Irvin, mentions a number that there, it wasn't just one person who had described this to him.
Right, absolutely. And I apologize if I mischaracterized saying that was the whistleblower. But anyone speaking with the whistleblower who has also cooperated with an inspector general investigation, which would have happened, and those are the folks that the president is referring to, they are also protected under the law from retaliation. They cannot experience any adverse employment consequences. They can't get fired. They can't get demoted. They can't have a security clearance revoked because they cooperated with an inspector general's investigation. And according to the reports, I think that's what's happened here.
All right. Irvin, thanks very much. And let me just clarify, it's a little unclear to me just from how the story is recounted in the Times. It sounds to me like it's the person speaking to the whistleblower, but it's a little unclear to me. Thank you, Irvin McCullough, for joining us from the Government Accountability Project. And also thank you, Professor Robert Turner, University of Virginia, where he's a law professor and distinguished fellow. We have much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk right here on 89.3 KPECC.